You win. We'll stop trying to have a baby.
I wouldn't exactly describe that as winning. It just seems necessary.
Whatever. Henry climbs off the bed and sits on the floor with me.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He kisses me. I imagine the bleak November day in 1986 that Henry has just come from. The wind, the warmth of his body in the cold orchard. Soon, for the first time in many months, we are making love without worrying about the consequences. Henry has caught the cold I had 16 years ago. 4 weeks later, Henry has had his vasectomy, and I discover that I am pregnant for the sixth time.
Baby Dreams. September 2000. Claire is 29. I dream I'm walking downstairs into my grandmother Abshire's basement. The long soot mark from the time the crow flew down the chimney is still there on the left-hand wall. The steps are dusty, and the handrail leaves gray marks on my hand as I steady myself. I descend and walk into the room that always scared me when I was little. In this room are deep shelves with rows and rows of canned goods, tomatoes and pickles, corn relish and beets. They look embalmed. In one of the jars is the small fetus of a duck. I carefully open the jar and pour the duckling and the fluid into my hand. It gasps and retches. "Why did you leave me?" it asks when it can speak. "I've been waiting for you." I dream that my mother and I are walking together down a quiet, residential street in South Haven. I am carrying a baby. As we walk, the baby becomes heavier and heavier until I can barely lift it. I turn to Mama and tell her that I can't carry this baby any farther. She takes it from me easily and we continue on. We come to a house and walk down the small walkway to its backyard. In the yard, there are two screens and a slide projector. People are seated in lawn chairs, watching slides of trees. Half of a tree is on each screen. One half is summer and the other winter. They are the same tree, different seasons. The baby laughs and cries out in delight. I dream I am standing on the Sedgwick L platform, waiting for the Brown Line train. I am carrying two shopping bags, which upon inspection turn out to contain boxes of saltine crackers and a very small, stillborn baby with red hair wrapped in saran wrap. I dream I am at home in my old room. It's late at night. The room is dimly illuminated by the aquarium light. I suddenly realize with horror that there is a small animal swimming round and round the tank. I hastily remove the lid and net the animal, which turns out to be a gerbil with gills. "I'm so sorry," I say. "I forgot about you." The gerbil just stares at me reproachfully. I dream I am walking upstairs in Meadowlark House. All the furniture is gone. The rooms are empty. Dust floats in the sunlight, which makes golden pools on the polished oak floors. I walk down the long hall, glancing in the bedrooms, and come to my room, in which a small wooden cradle sits alone. There is no sound. I am afraid to look into the cradle. In Mama's room, white sheets are spread over the floor. At my feet is a tiny drop of blood, which touches the tip of a sheet and spreads as I watch until the entire floor is covered in blood. Saturday, September 23rd, 2000. Claire is 29. Henry is 37. I'm living underwater. Everything seems slow and far away. I know there's a world up there, a sunlit, quick world where time runs like dry sand through an hourglass. But down here, where I am, air and sound and time and feeling are thick and dense. I'm in a diving bell with this baby. Just the two of us trying to survive in this alien atmosphere. But I feel very alone. "Hello? Are you there?" No answer comes back. "He's dead," I tell Amit.
"No," she says, smiling anxiously. "No, Claire, see? There's his heartbeat."
I can't explain. Henry hovers around trying to feed me, massage me, cheer me up until I snap at him. I walk across the yard into my studio. It's like a museum, a mausoleum, so still, nothing living or breathing. No ideas here, just things. Things that stare at me accusingly.
I'm sorry, I tell my blank, empty drawing table, my dry vats and molds, the half-made sculptures. Stillborn, I think, looking at the blue iris paper-wrapped armature that seemed so hopeful in June. My hands are clean and soft and pink. I hate them. I hate this emptiness. I hate this baby. No, no, I don't hate him. I just can't find him. I sit at my drawing board with a pencil in my hand and a sheet of white paper before me. Nothing comes. I close my eyes and all I can think of is red, so I get a tube of watercolor, cadmium, red, dark, and I get a big mop of a brush and I fill a jar with water and I begin to cover the paper with red. It glistens. The paper is limp with moisture and darkens as it dries. I watch it drying. It smells of gum arabic. In the center of the paper, very small in black ink, I draw a heart. Not a silly Valentine, but an anatomically correct heart, tiny, doll-like. And then veins, delicate road maps of veins that reach all the way to the edges of the paper, that hold the small heart enmeshed like a fly in a spider web. See, there's his heartbeat. It has become evening. I empty the water jar and wash the brush. I lock the studio door, cross the yard, and let myself in the back door. Henry is making spaghetti sauce. He looks up as I come in. Better? He asks. Better, I reassure him and myself. Wednesday, September 27th, 2000. Claire is 29. It's lying on the bed. There's some blood, but not so much. It's lying on its back, trying to breathe, its tiny rib cage quivering. But it's too soon. It's convulsing, and blood is gushing from the cord in time with the beating of its heart. I kneel beside the bed and pick it up, pick him up, my tiny boy, jerking like a small, freshly caught fish, drowning in air. I hold him so gently, but he doesn't know I'm here holding him. He is slippery, and his skin is almost imaginary. His eyes are closed, and I think wildly of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, of 911 and Henry. Oh, don't go before Henry can see you. But his breath is bubbling with fluid. Small sea creature breathing water. And then he opens his mouth wide, and I can see right through him, and my hands are empty, and he's gone. Gone. I don't know how long. Time passes. I am kneeling. Kneeling, I pray, dear God, dear God, dear God. The baby stirs in my womb. Hush! Hide! I wake up in the hospital. Henry is there. The baby is dead.
Seven. Thursday, December 28th, 2000. Henry is 33 and 37. Claire is 29. I am standing in our bedroom in the future. It's night, but moonlight gives the room a surreal, monochromatic distinctness. My ears are ringing, as they often do in the future. I look down on Claire and myself sleeping. Feels like death. I am sleeping tightly balled up, knees to chest, wound up in blankets, mouth slightly open. I want to touch me. I want to hold me in my arms, look into my eyes. But it won't happen that way. I stand for long minutes staring intently at my sleeping future self. Eventually I walk softly to Claire's side of the bed, kneel. It feels immensely like the present. I will myself to forget the other body in the bed, to concentrate on Claire. She stirs, her eyes open. She isn't sure where we are, neither am I. I am overwhelmed by desire, by a longing to be connected to Claire as strongly as possible, to be here, now. I kiss her very lightly, lingering, thinking about nothing. She is drunk with sleep, moves her hand to my face, and wakes more as she feels the solidity of me. Now she is present. She runs her hand down my arm, a caress. I carefully peel the sheet from her so as not to disturb the other me, of whom Claire is still not aware. I wonder if this other self is somehow impervious to waking, but decide not to find out. I'm lying on top of Claire, covering her completely with my body. I wish I could stop her from turning her head, but she will turn her head any minute now. As I penetrate Claire, she looks at me, and I think I don't exist. And a second later, she turns her head and sees me. She cries out, not loudly, and looks back at me, above her, in her. Then she remembers, accepts it. This is pretty strange, but it's okay. And in this moment, I love her more than life. Monday, February 12th, 2001. Henry is 37, Claire is 29. Claire has been in a strange mood all week. She's distracted. It is as though something only Claire can hear has riveted her attention, as though she's receiving revelations from God through her fillings, or trying to decode satellite transmissions of Russian cryptology in her head. When I ask her about it, she just smiles and shrugs. This is so unlike Claire that I am alarmed and immediately desist. I come home from work one evening and I can see just by looking at Claire that something awful has happened. Her expression is scared and pleading. She comes close to me and stops and doesn't say anything. Someone has died, I think. Who has died? Dad? Kimmy? Philip? Say something, I ask. What's happened? I'm pregnant. How can you... Even as I say it, I know exactly how. Never mind. I remember. For me, that night was years ago, but for Claire, it is only weeks in the past. I was coming from 1996, when we were trying desperately to conceive, and Claire was barely awake. I curse myself for a careless fool. Claire is waiting for me to say something. I force myself to smile. Big surprise. Yeah. She looks a little teary. I take her into my arms and she holds me tightly. Scared? I murmur into Claire's hair. Uh-huh. You were never scared before. I was crazy before. Now I know what it is. What can happen? We stand and think about what can happen. I hesitate. We could... I let it hang. No, I can't. It's true, Claire can't. Once a Catholic, always a Catholic. I say, maybe it'll be good. A happy accident. Claire smiles and I realize that she wants this. That she actually hopes that 7 will be our lucky number. My throat contracts, and I have to turn away.
Tuesday, February 20th, 2001. Claire is 29. Henry is 37. The clock radio clicks on at 7:46 a.m., and National Public Radio sadly tells me that there has been a plane crash somewhere, and 86 people are dead. I'm pretty sure I am one of them. Henry's side of the bed is empty. I close my eyes, and I am in a little berth in a cabin on an ocean liner pitching over rough seas. I sigh, and gingerly creep out of bed and into the bathroom. I'm still throwing up 10 minutes later when Henry sticks his head in the door and asks me if I'm okay. Great! Never better! He perches on the edge of the tub. I would just as soon not have an audience for this. Should I be worried? You never threw up at all before. Amit says this is good. I'm supposed to throw up. It's something about my body recognizing the baby as part of me instead of a foreign body. Amit has been giving me this drug they give people who have organ transplants. Maybe I should bank some more blood for you today. Henry and I are both type O. I nod and throw up. We are avid blood bankers. He has needed transfusions twice, and I have had 3, one of them requiring a huge amount. I sit for a minute and then stagger to my feet. Henry steadies me. I wipe my mouth and brush my teeth.
Henry goes downstairs to make breakfast. I suddenly have an overpowering desire for oatmeal.
Oatmeal!
I yell down the stairs.
Okay.
I begin to brush out my hair. My reflection in the mirror shows me pink and puffy. I thought pregnant women were supposed to glow. I am not glowing. Oh well, I'm still pregnant, and that's all that counts.
Thursday, April 19th, 2001. Henry is 37, Claire is 29. We are at Amit Montague's office for the ultrasound. Claire and I have been both eager and reluctant to have an ultrasound. We have refused amniocentesis because we are sure we will lose the baby if we poke a huge long needle at it. Claire is 18 weeks pregnant, halfway there. If we could fold time in half right now, like a Rorschach test, this would be the crease down the middle. We live in a state of holding breath, afraid to exhale for fear of breathing out the baby too soon. We sit in the waiting room with other expectant couples and mothers with strollers and toddlers who run around bumping into things. Dr. Montague's office always depresses me because we have spent so much time here being anxious and hearing bad news. But today is different. Today everything will be okay. A nurse calls our names. We repair to an examining room. Claire gets undressed and gets on the table and is greased and scanned. The technician watches the monitor. Amit Montague, who is tall and regal and French-Moroccan, watches the monitor. Claire and I hold hands. We watch the monitor, too. Slowly, the image builds itself bit by bit. On the screen is a weather map of the world, or a galaxy, a swirl of stars, or a baby. Bien joué, une fille, Dr. Montague says. She is sucking her thumb. She is very pretty and very big. Claire and I exhale. On the screen, a pretty galaxy is sucking her thumb. As we watch, she takes her hand away from her mouth. Dr. Montague says, she smiles, and so do we.
Monday, August 20th, 2001. Claire is 30. Henry is 38. The baby is due in 2 weeks, and we still haven't settled on a name for her. In fact, we've barely discussed it. We've been avoiding the whole subject superstitiously, as though naming the baby will cause the Furies to notice her and torment her. Finally, Henry brings home a book called Dictionary of Given Names. We are in bed. It's only 8:30 p.m., and I'm wiped out. I lie on my side, my belly a peninsula, facing Henry, who lies on his side, facing me with his head propped on his arm, the book on the bed between us. We look at each other, smile nervously. Any thoughts? He says, leafing through the book. Jane, I reply. He makes a face. Jane? I used to name all my dolls and stuffed animals Jane, every one of them. Henry looks it up. It means gift of God. That works for me. Let's have something a little unusual. How about Eret or Jadotha? He riffs through the pages. Here's a good one. Lululua. It's Arabic for pearl. How about pearl? I picture the baby as a smooth, iridescent white ball. Henry runs his finger down the columns. Okay. Latin, a probable variant of perula in reference to the most valued form of this product of disease. Ugh, what's wrong with this book? I take it from Henry, and for kicks look up Henry, Teutonic, ruler of the home, chief of the dwelling. He laughs. Look up Claire. It's just another form of Clara. Latin, illustrious, bright. That's good, he says. I flip through the book randomly. Philomele? I like that, says Henry. But what of the horrible nickname issue? Philly? Mel? Pyrene, Greek, red-haired. But what if she isn't? Henry reaches over the book and picks up a handful of my hair and puts the ends in his mouth. I pull it away from him and push all my hair behind me. I thought we knew everything there was to know about this kid. Surely Kendrick tested for red hair, I say.
Henry retrieves the book from me. Isolde?
Zoe?
I like Zoe. Zoe has possibilities.
What's it mean?
Life.
Yeah, that's very good. Bookmark that.
Eliza? Henry offers.
Elizabeth.
Henry looks at me, hesitates.
Annette.
Lucy.
No,
Henry says firmly.
No, I agree.
What we need, Henry says, is a fresh start, a blank slate.
Let's call her Tabula Rasa.
Let's call her Titanium White.
Blanche, Blanca, Bianca,
Alba, I say, as in Duchess of
Alba de Tamble.
It rolls around in my mouth as I say it.
That's nice. All the little iambs tripping along.
He's flipping through the book. Alba, Latin, white. Provençal, dawn of day. Hmm. He laboriously clambers off the bed. I can hear him rummaging around in the living room. He returns after a few minutes with volume one of the OED, the big Random House dictionary, and my decrepit old Encyclopedia Americana, book one, A2 annuals. A dawn song of the Provençal poets, in honor of their mistresses. Réveillés à l'aurore par le cri du guetteur, deux amants qui viennent de passer la nuit ensemble se séparent en maudisant le jour qui vient trop tôt. Tel est le thème, non moins invariable que celui de la pastorelle, d'un genre dont le nom est emprunté au mot Alba, qui figure parfois au début de la pièce, et régulièrement à la fin de chaque couplet où il forme refrain.
How sad. Let's try Random House.
This is better. A white city on a hill, a fortress. He jettisons Random House off the bed and opens the encyclopedia.
Aesop, Age of Reason, Alaska. Okay, here, Alba.
He scans the entry.
A bunch of now wiped out towns in ancient Italy and the Duke of Alba.
I sigh and turn onto my back. The baby stirs. She must have been sleeping. Henry is back to perusing the OED.
Amour, amorous, armadillo, bazooms. Goodness, the things they print these days in works of reference.
He slides his hand under my nightgown, runs it slowly over my taut stomach. The baby kicks, hard, just where his hand is, and he starts and looks at me, amazed. His hands are roaming, finding their way across familiar and unfamiliar terrain.
How many de Tambles can you fit in there?
Oh, there's always room for one more.
Alba, he says softly.
A white city. An impregnable fortress on a white hill.
She'll like it.
Henry is pulling my underwear down my legs and over my ankles. He tosses it off the bed and looks at me.
Careful,
I tell him.
Very careful,
he agrees as he strips off his clothes. I feel immense, like a continent in a sea of pillows and blankets. Henry bends over me from behind, moves over me, an explorer mapping my skin with his tongue. Slowly, slowly, I am afraid. A song sung by the troubadours at dawn, he is whispering to me as he enters me. To their mistresses, I reply. My eyes are closed, and I hear Henry as though from the next room. Just so. And then, yes. Yes.
Alba, an introduction. Wednesday, November 16th, 2011. Henry is 38, Claire is 40. I'm in the Surrealist galleries at the Art Institute of Chicago in the future. I am not perfectly dressed. The best I could do was a long black winter coat from the coat check room and pants from a guard's locker. I did manage to find shoes, which are always the most difficult thing to get, So I figure I'll lift a wallet, buy a T-shirt in the museum store, have lunch, see some art, and then launch myself out of the building and into the world of shops and hotel rooms. I have no idea where I am in time. Not too far out there. The clothing and haircuts are not too different from 2001. I'm simultaneously excited about this little sojourn and disturbed, because in my present, Claire is about to have Alba at any moment, and I absolutely want to be there. But, on the other hand, this is an unusually high-quality slice of forward time travel. I feel strong and really present, really good. So I stand quietly in a dark room full of spotlit Joseph Cornell boxes, watching a school group following a docent, carrying little stools which they obediently sit on when she tells them to park themselves. I observe the group. The docent is the usual, a well-groomed woman in her 50s with impossibly blonde hair and taut face. The teacher, a good-humored young woman wearing light blue lipstick, stands at the back of the flock of students, ready to contain any who get boisterous. It's the students who interest me. They're all about 10 or so, 5th grade, I guess that would be. It's a Catholic school, so they all wear identical clothes, green plaid for the girls and navy blue for the boys. They are attentive and polite, but not excited. Too bad. I would think Cornell would be perfect for kids. The docent seems to think they are younger than they are. She talks to them as though they are little children. There's a girl in the back row who seems more engaged than the rest. I can't see her face. She has long, curly black hair and a peacock blue dress, which sets her apart from her peers. Every time the docent asks a question, this girl's hand goes up, but the docent never calls on her. I can see that the girl is getting fed up. The docent is talking about Cornell's aviary boxes. Each box is bleak, and many have white, painted interiors with perches and the kind of holes that a birdhouse would have, and some have pictures of birds. They are the starkest and most austere of his pieces, without the whimsy of the soap bubble sets or the romance of the hotel boxes. "Why do you think Mr. Cornell made these boxes?" The docent brightly scans the children for a reply, ignoring the peacock blue girl who is waving her hand like she has St. Vitus dance. A boy in the front says shyly that the artist must have liked birds. This is too much for the girl. She stands up with her hand in the air. The docent reluctantly says, "Yes?"
"He made the boxes because he was lonely. He didn't have anyone to love, and he made the boxes so he could love them, and so people would know that he existed, and because birds are free, and the boxes are hiding places for the birds so they will feel safe, and he wanted to be free and be safe. The boxes are for him so he can be a bird."
The girl sits down. I am blown away by her answer. This is a 10-year-old who can empathize with Joseph Cornell. Neither the docent nor the class exactly knows what to make of this, but the teacher, who is obviously used to her, says, "Thank you, Alba. That's very perceptive." She turns and smiles gratefully at the teacher, and I see her face. And I am looking at my daughter. I have been standing in the next gallery, and I take a few steps forward to look at her, to see her, and she sees me. And her face lights up, and she jumps up, knocks over her little folding chair, and almost before I know it, I am holding Alba in my arms, holding her tight, kneeling before her with my arms around her, and she says, "Daddy," over and over. Everyone is gaping at us. The teacher hurries over. She says, "Alba, who is this? Sir, who are you?"
"I'm Henry de Tamble, Alba's father."
"He's my daddy!"
The teacher is almost wringing her hands. "Sir, Alba's father is dead." I am speechless. But Alba, daughter mine, has a grip on the situation.
"He's dead," she tells her teacher, "but he's not continuously dead."
I find my wits. It's kind of hard to explain.
"He's a CDP," says Alba, "like me."
This seems to make perfect sense to the teacher, although it means nothing to me. The teacher is a bit pale under her makeup, but she looks sympathetic. Alba squeezes my hand.
Say something, is what she means.
Ms. Cooper. Ms. Cooper, is there any possibility that Alba and I could have a few minutes here to talk?
We don't see each other much. Well, we're on a field trip. The group... I can't let you just take the child away from the group, and I don't really know that you are Mr. DeTamble, you see.
Let's call Mama, says Alba.
She runs over to her school bag and whips out a cell phone. She presses a key and I hear the phone ringing, and I'm rapidly realizing that there are possibilities here. Someone picks up on the other end, and Alba says,
Mama, I'm at the Art Institute. No, I'm okay. Mama, Daddy's here. Tell Mrs. Cooper it's really Daddy, okay? Yeah, okay, bye.
I hesitate, pull my head together. Claire? There's a sharp intake of breath. Claire?
Henry! Oh, God, I can't believe it! Come home.
I'll try.
When are you from?
2001, just before Alba was born. I smile at Alba. She is leaning against me, holding my hand.
Well, maybe I should come down there.
Well, that would be faster. Listen, could you tell this teacher that I'm really me?
Sure.
Where will you be?
At the Lions.
Come as fast as you can, Claire. It won't be much longer.
I love you.
I love you, Claire. I hesitate and then hand the phone to Mrs. Cooper. She and Claire have a short conversation in which Claire somehow convinces her to let me take Alba to the museum entrance, where Claire will meet us. I thank Mrs. Cooper, who has been pretty graceful in a weird situation, and Alba and I walk hand in hand out of the Morton Wing, down the spiral staircase, and into Chinese ceramics. My mind is racing. What to ask first?
Alba says, Thank you for the videos. Mama gave them to me for my birthday.
What videos?
I can do the Yale and the Master, and I'm working on the Walters.
Locks. She's learning to pick locks.
Well, great. Keep at it.
Listen, Alba?
Daddy?
What's a CDP?
Chrono-displaced person.
We sit down on a bench in front of a Tang Dynasty porcelain dragon. Alba sits facing me with her hands in her lap.
She looks exactly like me at 10. I can hardly believe any of this. Alba isn't even born yet, and here she is. Athena, sprung full-blown.
I level with her. You know, this is the first time I've met you. Alba smiles.
How do you do?
She is the most self-possessed child I've ever met. I scrutinize her. Where is Claire in this child?
Do we see each other much?
She considers.
Not much. It's been about a year. I saw you a few times when I was 8.
How old were you when I died? I hold my breath. 5.
Jesus. I can't deal with this. I'm sorry.
Should I not have said that?
Alba is contrite. I hug her to me.
It's okay.
I asked, didn't I? I take a deep breath. How is Claire?
Okay.
Sad. This pierces me. I realize I don't want to know anything more.
What about you? How's school? What are you learning?
Alba grins.
I'm not learning much in school, but I'm reading all about early instruments and Egypt, and Mama and I are reading Lord of the Rings, and I'm learning a tango by Astor Piazzolla.
At 10? Heavens.
Violin? Who's your teacher?
Gramps.
For a moment, I think she means my grandfather, and then I realize she means Dad. This is great. If Dad is spending time with Alba, she must actually be good.
Are you good? What a rude question.
Yes, I'm very good.
Thank God.
I was never any good at music. That's what Gramps says,
she giggles.
But you like music.
I love music. I just can't play it myself.
I heard Grandma Annette sing. She was so beautiful.
Which recording? I saw her for real, at the Lyric. She was singing Aida.
She's a CDP, like me.
Oh, shit. You time travel?
Sure.
Alba smiles happily. Mama always says you and I are exactly alike. Dr. Kendrick says I'm a prodigy.
How so?
Sometimes I can go when and where I want.
Alba looks pleased with herself. I'm so envious.
Can you not go at all if you don't want to?
Well, no.
She looks embarrassed.
But I like it. I mean, sometimes it's not convenient, but it's interesting, you know?
Yes, I know.
Come and visit me if you can be any time you want.
I tried. I saw you once on the street. You were with a blonde woman. You seemed like you maybe were busy, though.
Alba blushes, and all of a sudden Claire peeks out at me for just a tiny fraction of a second.
That was Ingrid. I dated her before I met your mom.
I wonder what we were doing, Ing and I, back then, that Alba is so discomfited by.
I feel a pang of regret that I made a poor impression on this sober and lovely girl. Speaking of your mom, we should go out front and wait for her.
The high-pitched whining noise has set in, and I just hope Claire will get here before I'm gone.
Alba and I get up and quickly make our way to the front steps. It's late fall, and Alba doesn't have a coat, so I wrap mine around both of us. I'm leaning against the granite slab that supports one of the lions facing south, and Alba leans against me, encased in my coat, pressed against my bare torso with just her face sticking out at the level of my chest. It's a rainy day. Traffic swims along on Michigan Avenue. I am drunk with the overwhelming love I feel for this amazing child, who presses against me as though she belongs to me, as though we will never be separated, as though we have all the time in the world. I am clinging to this moment, fighting fatigue and the pulling of my own time. Let me stay, I implore my body, God, Father, Time, Santa, anybody who might be listening. Just let me see Claire, and I'll come along peacefully.
There's Mama, says Alba.
A white car, unfamiliar to me, is speeding toward us. It pulls up to the intersection, and Claire jumps out, leaving it where it is, blocking traffic.
Henry!
I try to run to her. She is running, and I collapse onto the steps, and I stretch out my arms toward Claire. Alba is holding me and yelling something, and Claire is only a few feet from me, and I use my last reserves of will to look at Claire, who seems so far away, and I say as clearly as I can, I love you. And I'm gone.
Damn. Damn.
7:20 p.m. Friday, August 24th, 2001. Claire is 30. Henry is 38. I am lying on the battered chaise lounge in the backyard, with books and magazines cast adrift all around me, and a half-drunk glass of lemonade, now diluted with melted ice cubes, at my elbow. It's beginning to cool off a bit. It was 85 degrees earlier. Now there's a breeze, and the cicadas are singing their late summer song. 15 jets have passed over me on their way to O'Hare from distances unknown. My belly looms before me, anchoring me to this spot. Henry has been gone since 8 o'clock yesterday morning, and I am beginning to be afraid. What if I go into labor and he's not here? What if I have the baby and he still isn't back? What if he's hurt? What if he's dead? What if I die? These thoughts chase each other like those weird fur pieces old ladies used to wear around their necks with a tail in the mouth, circling around until I can't stand one more minute of it. Usually I like to fret in a whirl of activity. I worry about Henry while I scrub down the studio or do 9 loads of wash or pull 3 posts of paper. But now I lie here, beached by my belly in the early evening sun of our backyard, while Henry is out there, doing whatever it is that he is doing. Oh, God, bring him back. Now. But nothing happens. Mr. Panetta drives down the alley, and his garage door screeches open and then closed. A good humor truck comes and goes.
The fireflies begin their evening revels, but no Henry. I am getting hungry. I am going to starve to death in the backyard because Henry is not here to make dinner. Alba is squirming around, and I consider getting up and going into the kitchen and fixing some food and eating it. But then I decide to do the same thing I always do when Henry isn't around to feed me. I get up slowly in increments and walk sedately into the house. I find my purse, and I turn on a few lights, and I let myself out the front door and lock it. It feels good to be moving. Once again, I am surprised, and I'm surprised to be surprised, that I am so huge in one part of my body only, like someone whose plastic surgery has gone wrong, like one of those women in an African tribe whose idea of beauty requires extremely elongated necks or lips or earlobes. I balance my weight against Alba's, and in this Siamese twin dancing manner we walk to the Opart Thai restaurant. The restaurant is cool and full of people. I am ushered to a table in the front window. I order spring rolls and pad thai with tofu, bland and safe. I drink a whole glass of water. Alba presses against my bladder. I go to the restroom, and when I come back, food is on the table. I eat. I imagine the conversation Henry and I would be having if he were here. I wonder where he might be. I mentally comb through my memory, trying to fit the Henry who vanished while putting on his pants yesterday with any Henry I have seen in my childhood. This is a waste of time. I'll just have to wait for the story from himself. Maybe he's back. I have to stop myself from bolting out of the restaurant to go check. The entree arrives. I squeeze lime over the noodles and scoop them into my mouth. I picture Alba, tiny and pink, curled inside me, eating pad thai with tiny, delicate chopsticks. I picture her with long black hair and green eyes. She smiles and says, "Thanks, Mama." I smile and tell her, "You're welcome. So very welcome." She has a tiny stuffed animal in there with her, named Alfonso. Alba gives Alfonso some tofu. I finish eating. I sit for a few minutes resting. Someone at the next table lights up a cigarette. I pay and leave. I toddle down Western Avenue. A car full of Puerto Rican teenagers yells something at me, but I don't catch it. Back at the ranch, I fumble for my keys, and Henry swings the door open and says, "Thank God," and flings his arms around me. We kiss. I am so relieved to see him that it takes me a few minutes to realize that he is also extremely relieved to see me. "Where have you been?" Henry demands.
"Opart, where have you been?"
"You didn't leave a note, and I came home and you weren't here, and I thought you were at the hospital, so I called, but they said you weren't."
I start laughing, and it's hard to stop. Henry looks perplexed. When I can say something, I tell him,
"Now you know how it feels."
He smiles.
"Sorry, but I didn't know where you were, and I sort of panicked. I thought I'd missed Alba."
"But where were you?"
Henry grins. "Wait till you hear this. Just a minute. Let's sit down."
"Let's lie down. I'm beat."
"What'd you do all day?"
"Laid around."
"Poor Claire. No wonder you're tired." I go into the bedroom and turn on the air conditioner and pull the shades. Henry veers into the kitchen and appears after a few minutes with drinks. I arrange myself on the bed and receive ginger ale. Henry kicks off his shoes and joins me with a beer in hand. "Tell all."
"Well."
He raises one eyebrow and opens his mouth and closes it.
"I don't know how to begin."
"Spit it out."
"I have to start by saying that this is by far the weirdest thing that has ever happened to me."
"Weirder than you and me?"
"Yeah, I mean, that felt reasonably natural, boy meets girl."
"Weirder than watching your mom die over and over?"
"Well, that's just a horrible routine by now. It's a bad dream I have every so often. No, this was just surreal."
He runs his hand over my belly.
"I went forward, and I was really there, you know, coming in strong, and I ran into our little girl here."
"Oh, my God. I'm so jealous. But wow."
"Yeah. She was about 10. Claire, she is so amazing. She's smart and musical and just really confident and nothing fazed her?
What does she look like?
Me. A girl version of me. I mean, she's beautiful. She's got your eyes, but basically she looks a lot like me. Black hair, pale with a few freckles, and her mouth is smaller than mine was, and her ears don't stick out. She had long curly hair, and my hands with the long fingers, and she's tall. She was like a young cat. Perfect. Perfect. I'm afraid my genes have had their way with her. She was like you in personality, though. She had the most amazing presence. I saw her in a group of schoolchildren at the Art Institute, and she was talking about Joseph Cornell's aviary boxes, and she said something heartrending about him, and somehow I knew who she was. And she recognized me. Well, I would hope so. I have to ask. Does she... Is she... Henry hesitates. Yes, he finally says. She does. We are both silent. He strokes my face. I know. I want to cry. Claire? She seemed happy. I asked her. She said she likes it. He smiles.